two landmark cases in 2 days as a topic that is moving quickly in terms of public opinion comes before a court that tends to move slowly.
But as the Supreme Court considers gay marriage, how much does the public's opinion matter? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, polls swung sharply against drone strikes in response to a filibuster, supposedly the definition of content-free political speech.
I will speak as long as it takes until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast that no American should be killed by a drone on American soil.
Plus, how and why Knicks basketball broadcasting legend Walt Frazier developed his fabulous alter ego, Clyde.
I wasn't playing well, so in order to pacify myself, I went shopping. So I dress up in my room and go in the mirror. Well, I'm not playing good, but I still look good.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering two major cases on same-sex marriage.
The questions are huge.
A topic that is moving quickly in terms of public opinion comes before a court that tends to move slowly.
One possible outcome, the recognition of same-sex marriage nationwide. And if that happens, it will be one of a series of landmark rulings extending the rights of citizens. Brown versus the Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, Miranda, and so on. But how much does the Supreme Court change the public's perspective on those issues? And how much does public opinion influence the court? NYU law professor Barry Friedman has written a book on that very question and says the answer is that contrary to popular belief,
as I show in my book, The Will of the People, on countless important issues, the Supreme Court tends to come into line with public opinion over time.
Give me examples of cases where you think the court was kind of destined by the trends in public opinion to make the decisions it's made.
I think actually an interesting place to start is with the issue of gay rights, the issue on the plate this week. The Supreme Court confronted that issue in terms of gay sex in Bowers versus Hardwick in the early 1980s and found that state laws that banned what was called then homosexual sodomy were constitutional. That was the height of the scare about AIDS, and people were very leery of homosexuality. But there is something ironic that happens, which is that when the Supreme Court decides a case, the people who agree with it tend to nod and go back about their business. It's the people who are shocked by the decision or outraged by the decision that tend to mobilize in the political arena. We saw that after Roe versus Wade, when the right organized and really led the country into a period of much more conservative politics. And we saw it after Bowers versus Hardwick, when the gay community organized in an extremely effective way. And 20 years later, we saw the Supreme Court flip around in Lawrence versus Texas and find that all of the state laws that banned homosexual sodomy, as it was again then called, were unconstitutional.
There are cases, are there not, though, where the court seems ahead of public opinion? I'm thinking of Miranda, which decades and decades into its history still seems to be understood by a majority of Americans as giving extra rights to the criminally accused.
At the time the court decided the case, it looked like public opinion and the culture very much favored what it was doing. Miranda came at the end of a long line of Supreme Court decisions expanding the rights of criminal defendants, very much driven by concerns about race and justice in the United States. I mean, another one is Gideon versus Wainwright, saying that people had a right to a lawyer, and it went down very happily in the country. But right when Miranda got decided, crime rates shot up in this country, and Richard Nixon took advantage of that and ran against the court and soured the whole Miranda story. Sometimes what happens is the court decides a case. There's a compelling story about why it was consistent with the culture, but then for whatever reason, there's a backlash.
So coming back to gay marriage, the opposition to it in polls seems to be minimal. But as you analyze this highly polarized court, what's your prediction?
Very often, the Supreme Court finds itself in line with public opinion or the culture by looking at what a majority of the states do, rather than looking at public opinion polls, though there are examples of that. But in this case, you get a split in terms of gay marriage. So if you look at public opinion and you look at the polls, it looks like there's, you know, just over majority support. But if you look at the state laws, they're all still very much negative on the question of gay marriage. And so this case presents the court with a challenge. It was hard to say after the argument. I think that there were hints in every direction. Most importantly, Justice Kennedy, who sits squarely in the middle of the court on this issue and is going to be the deciding vote, made comments that looked in both directions dramatically.
We're speaking of the Supreme Court as an institution, but the court as it stands now is so polarized that Justice Kennedy is usually the swing vote. Does the history of how the court behaves have anything to do with this particular set of justices where Justice Kennedy sort of gets to decide the law for the immediate future?
Well, if you stop and think about it, there are 9 justices on the court, so somebody will always be in the middle. People often ask, how does the Supreme Court end up following public opinion over time, following the culture? But as you rightly observe, often it doesn't take 9 justices, it just takes 1. And that justice in the middle, by definition, is likely to be somebody who tends to be more attuned to the grays instead of the black and whites.
What's your best guess?
Look, here's what I think that Anthony Kennedy's going to want to do. He's been a big supporter of gay rights throughout his time on the court, and it's a matter about which he feels passionately. On the other hand, he's a big supporter of federalism, and he doesn't like to stomp on what the states are doing. So if I were Anthony Kennedy, I'd want to figure out a way to give a favorable nod to the issue of gay marriage, move the needle a little bit on the issue in the right direction while saying we need to give it a little bit more time. And that's the kind of statement he likes to make. And in both of the cases that are in front of the court this week, there is some wiggle room to do something unusual like that.
Barry, thank you so much.
Been my pleasure.
Barry Friedman is the author of The Will of the People. On the subject of public opinion, in early March, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, with a little help from a few fellow senators, pulled off a good old-fashioned 13-hour-long filibuster.
I will speak as long as it takes until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast that no American should be killed by a drone on American soil without first being charged with a crime.
There was some comic relief, such as when Marco Rubio pitched in with some hip-hop lyrics while giving his colleague a break.
That takes me back to another modern-day poet by the name of Jay-Z. In one of his songs he wrote, "It's funny what 7 days can change. It was all good just a week ago."
But Paul was serious, hammering away on America's use of drones. Specifically, he was pressuring the White House to answer a simple question. Would the United States use a drone to kill a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil? The White House finally replied to Paul's hypothetical with a simple no. But not only did his feat of endurance yield an answer, it actually may have changed minds about using drones to kill American terrorism suspects in other countries, which we have done at least once. This week, a Gallup poll found that fewer than half of those surveyed approved of using airstrikes to kill U.S. citizens living abroad who are suspected of terrorism. Slate's Dave Weigel, pondering the impact of the filibuster, said the Washington Post asked basically the same question a year ago and got a very different answer.
65% of people were fine with the idea of using a drone to take out a U.S. citizen who is now a terrorist in some other country. In this Gallup poll that came out last week, from 65% support, we went to 41%. There used to be only 26% against it. That had risen to 52%. That's a 50-point swing against it.
The idea that Paul continued to hit on was the notion of using drones to strike Americans on U.S. soil. Where does that even come from?
It's something that I think just immediately conjures the worst vision of what government could do. Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic suggested almost a year ago that drones might become the new black helicopters. In the 1990s, government paranoia was associated with the fear that there were mysterious black helicopters appearing at opportune times for the government. Drones started taking that role in ideological media, on Alex Jones's show online. Paul, in this filibuster, used a fairly slow news day to compel people to cover the issue in the way he defined it.
It's hard for me to imagine the mechanism for this pretty astonishing flip-flop in public opinion, because at the time, there wasn't that much coverage of the issue itself. The coverage of Paul's filibuster was very much procedural. To what do you attribute the turnaround?
It was kind of a slow-boiling thing. And once other Republicans came in to alleviate Paul's burden and do colloquies, that's when it became a partisan story. the press knows better how to process a partisan story than either a technological story or an ideological story. And I think for that reason, you saw this bursting floodgate open.
One thing about the drone program is that it's kind of an equal opportunity, paranoia opportunity, because the left has been spied on domestically a great deal, and the Tea Party is often talking about government overreach. Do you think that Rand Paul's filibuster struck a chord across the political spectrum?
It actually did. Paul, as a politician, has a real eye for this. Paul ends up either co-sponsoring legislation with a fellow iconoclast or kind of striking out on his own without legislation, just saying what the party should do to survive. And a couple of times this month, he managed to cross what we see as partisan lines by saying things that liberals enjoyed on immigration, on drones. He's done this before with foreign policy and aid.
All right, so he put all of his chips on double zero and it hit. And now it appears that Senator Paul is considering taking the big stack and once again putting it on double zero and filibustering the gun control legislation in the Senate. Do you think he's pushing his luck?
He, Ted Cruz, and Mike Lee, senators from Texas and Utah, respectively, have threatened to filibuster on guns. It could work some of the same way, but it's not an issue that surprises the press. Hearing Republicans say that they're stalwarts on guns is not new. I don't know how many times they can play the same trick on something that's already identified as a ideological conservative or as a partisan Republican issue.
You've mentioned Rand Paul and his colleagues, Republican colleagues in the Senate, Ted Cruz from Texas and Mike Lee from Utah. These three guys, to me, are extremists, and the less attention paid to them, the better. But what happened with this filibuster would seem to argue against my desires. Do you think we should pay less attention to Rand Paul and these other guys or more?
This is a real question for media, I think, because there is a temptation to cover people who hold the most press conferences and who make the most bold stands. It's often disconnected to the legislation that actually is going to pass.
Well, then back to drones. Given the pretty significant shift in public opinion, will this lead to legislation?
There weren't actually moves from Republicans. After the filibuster, John Boehner was asked if House Republicans, who have a lot of ability to investigate, if they would do so. And he kind of referred everyone in the press to Mike Rogers, the intelligence chairman in the House, to truncate what he said. Basically, drones are fine, don't worry. Ted Cruz tried to introduce an amendment to the budget that just passed that would prevent any drones from being used on citizens in American soil, and that didn't pass. You haven't seen anything move on that front. How do we get to that point? I'm not sure, but for all of the criticism and eye-rolling he draws, Rand Paul probably got us closer to that point.
All right, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Weigel covers politics for Slate.
Coming up, a counterintuitive take on the government's apparent crackdown on leakers.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's MSNBC's Rachel Maddow telling us some of what we know about drones and how we came to know it.
The closest we have come to learning about how the Obama administration justifies drone strikes is this. In the fall of 2011, New York Times reporter Charlie Savage wrote this story. This is about a week after Alaki was killed, Alaki, the U.S. citizen who was killed in Yemen. And the story describes a super secret 50-page memo written by an office within the Justice Department that effectively serves as the Obama administration's legal justification for why they think it's okay to kill an American citizen without a trial. Now, the New York Times did not actually get to see this memo. They did not publish the memo, nor did they quote from it directly. The memo was described to the reporter by anonymous sources.
In other words, the information came from a leak. We also know that the government is engaged in an unprecedented crackdown on leakers. In Obama's first term, the Justice Department prosecuted six of them, twice as many as all the previous administrations combined. Many call it a war on leakers, intended to send a signal that leaking and its kissing cousin whistleblowing will not be tolerated. But is it a signal? Columbia University law professor David Posen also is concerned about the uptick in prosecutions, but he says it may be obscuring what's really going on. His article, The Leaky Leviathan, to be published in December's Harvard Law Review, notes that the number of leak prosecutions is unprecedented.
But relative to the volume of potentially prosecutable leaks, it's a very small number. There was a nice study done recently that if you just take as a denominator leaks that we know to have been referred to the Justice Department for potential criminal action, something like 0.3% have been prosecuted in recent years.
If they're only pursuing 0.03%, why isn't the government going harder after leakers than they do?
I think an important place to start is with the distinction some journalists draw between what they call plants and what they call leaks. Plants are the authorized informal anonymous disclosures that serve administration ends. Leaks are the unauthorized disclosures. Plants are a critical tool for modern government for sending signals to allies and adversaries, floating trial balloons. They're not an incidental practice of a few craven officials. They're a mode of governance, especially in national security and foreign affairs, where so much of the relevant material is classified.
Can you give me an example?
Well, a lot has come out about the administration's drone program in places like Pakistan and the Horn of Africa. It's hard to know who said what, but these news stories have released a lot of information about what the program is meant to do, rules and standards it ostensibly follows. Whatever you think about the secrecy surrounding that broader program, there's no doubt that those disclosures have informed the American public to some pretty significant degree about what's happening. So if that's right, that planting is an important practice for any modern administration. For a strategy of planting to work, you need to allow, at least so I argue, some significant amount of leaking to happen as well. Why? Because if the government regularly went after all of the unauthorized disclosures, we would quickly become conditioned to think that everything we hear from anonymous government sources is really a plant.
What you're saying is that if they were to pursue leaks aggressively, then the leaks that appeared in the paper and went unpunished would be regarded as propaganda.
Basically, that's a sharp way to put it. I think the administration is actually experiencing this lesson to some degree right now because they brought six cases against leakers. Whenever a lot of people in Congress, civil society, and the media see in print an anonymous U.S. government official saying something that sounds sensitive and no sanction follows, people are becoming more and more cynical about thinking that likely came from the White House. In a phrase, plants need to be watered with leaks.
Well done. But if we stop talking about numbers and we just talk about people,
yeah.
Bradley Manning and his famously awful treatment by law enforcement and the perhaps life in prison that he could face. Isn't one prosecution like that enough to create such a chill that the numbers or the potential prosecutions, none of that really matters?
I think it's definitely right that the chill spreads well beyond the set of cases that are brought. And there's never any justification for mistreating a prisoner, pursuing an excessive penalty. It may be that high-level officials are happy to chill, the Bradley Mannings of the world. There are hundreds of thousands of employees with security clearances. It's one thing to think about some several hundred high-level officials playing this game of leaks. It may be seen as much more threatening to have potentially hundreds of thousands of people playing.
So if you are pro the system of leaking and you think it is essential to government, what about what's happening now?
I'm worried, like many people, about the direction in which things are going. I'm not sure, however, that they'll keep going in the direction they're going. It might be helpful to think about why the enforcement rate has gone up. There are a few leading candidates under Obama. One is technological, you know, because of new investigative tools, it's just become easier to figure out who did it without subpoenaing journalists. Another is institutional. The National Security Division was created within the Justice Department in 2006. That shares authority over leak cases with the FBI, may bring a more national security-minded less tolerant approach to these cases and also just more resources. All of those explanations may have something to them, but one explanation that has been floated, I think, is likely wrong. Some have speculated that the Obama White House has pressured the Justice Department. I think that may actually have it backwards. Historically, White Houses have sent a cautionary signal to the Justice Department to take it easy on leak cases, realizing the potential political and policy costs. This administration has been very concerned not to tamper with the Justice Department's prosecutorial activities as a backlash, perhaps, against what was seen as the excessive politicization of the Justice Department by the Bush administration. It's actually the lack of a restraining message from the White House that may have some explanatory power here.
Your bottom line is that leaks increase the public's trust in government, which is weirdly counterintuitive, and they enable the government to talk to itself, which is similarly counterintuitive.
While individual leaks can no doubt damage the president's agenda, on aggregate, leaks tend to actually promote government power to a significant degree. At least historically, they've done so.
And not just plants.
And not just plants. A lot of different parties' interests. There's some evidence, I think, as well, although it's very hard to tell, that very top people in the Obama administration may, however, want to pull back the reins a bit. There was a recent story in the New York Times in which close aides of the attorney general are reported as saying that the attorney general doesn't want leak prosecutions to be his legacy. I read it as a signal being sent from the attorney general to line-level prosecutors to slow down. If it's right that there are a lot of good strategic reasons, as well as high-minded, democratic, First Amendment-based reasons, why the government would want to be leaky, then I think there's cause to think that the enforcement uptick under Obama may be self-correcting. It may just be too costly for the president to sustain this level of skepticism and backlash that's followed.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David Posen is a law professor at Columbia University and author of the upcoming Harvard Law Review article, The Leaky Leviathan. We'll link to it on our website.
Anthony Lewis died on Monday at the age of 85. The venerable legal reporter and columnist for the New York Times was a two-time Pulitzer winner, widely regarded as having introduced constitutional scholarship to the role of covering the courts. Also, advocacy. A crusader in the way contemporary Times reporters cannot be, Lewis is believed to have influenced the very Supreme Court he covered. The pattern began early in his career with a Harvard Law Review article he wrote calling for federal judicial intervention in voting district apportionment, an argument that later prevailed in the Earl Warren Court's 1962 decision, Baker v. Carr. Not only was Lewis's scholarship footnoted in the decision, according to an obituary in ProPublica, the reporter lobbied then Solicitor General Archibald Cox and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy to file an amicable amicus brief. Thus was Lewis sometimes referred to, with varying degrees of endearment, as the 10th Justice. His activism did not end with the expansion of central judicial power. Lewis was also a full-throated advocate of free speech.
If there's a legal basis for this show, and frankly for the style of our coverage, it's the First Amendment, an ironclad protection for all manner of speech, popular and unpopular, a distinctly American bulwark against being silenced. Or so we believed. But when I spoke to Anthony Lewis in 2008 about his book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, he argued that the First Amendment often has been poorly protected by the courts. Part of the problem, he claimed, is that the language of the amendment was left intentionally vague by the founders, and there's virtually no record of their deliberations over what or what not to include.
Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. But what does that mean? It's a very sweeping-sounding statement, but it doesn't prevent laws against blackmail, which occurs by speech or press. It doesn't prevent laws against threats. It doesn't prevent laws providing copyright. So judges have to interpret it. The framers of the Constitution, the principal framer, James Madison and the others, deliberately wrote the Constitution in very open language because they knew that to last it would have to be something much broader than a bill of particulars. If you had tried to list every imaginable kind of scenario, the mind couldn't have anticipated what was going to happen.
So the first decisive test for the First Amendment came a dozen years later with the passage of the Sedition Act. That was the big one, right?
Sedition Act was a statute that followed the old British idea of seditious libel, which is criminal punishment of those who criticize the government, the church, the president, the king. And in the United States, the Sedition Act specifically punished malicious criticism of the president. It didn't punish criticism of the vice president, who happened to be Jefferson, the leader of the opposite party. And the real purpose of the act, though it was said by the Federalists who passed it, to be necessary to stop French Jacobin terrorism from creeping into the United States, the real purpose was to shut up Jeffersonian editors before the election of 1800, when Jefferson would oppose Adams. And a lot of them were sent to jail.
And so do we see the pattern being set here? Is it always a question of national security that puts the blinkers on the First Amendment?
I don't know that it's always, but it certainly is predominantly so, and that's what Madison said. Fear of events abroad will reduce constitutional rights at home. He predicted that, and it's happened again and again in our history. During World War I, at the behest of President Wilson, Congress passed a Sedition Act, and people were jailed for the most innocuous comments, you know, President Wilson's a fool, he's running the war badly, things like that. And they were sent to jail for lengthy terms. In a great case, a group of radicals who threw anonymous pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York, criticizing Wilson for sending American troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, were prosecuted under the 1918 Sedition Act and sent to prison for 20 years, 20 years for throwing a political pamphlet from the top of a building. It's incredible.
Then Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the decision that defended free speech.
Well, Holmes was an amazing man. The dissent that you're talking about, he wrote in 1919 in the case in which those people threw pamphlets from the top of a building in New York. And he said, memorably, "We have to allow the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death."
And yet he flip-flopped, it seemed, on this issue. As you recount in your book, he had no problem with Eugene Debs, a famous union leader, being tossed in the clink.
Eugene Debs was 5 times a Socialist Party candidate for president. He made a speech in Dayton, Ohio, and he expressed sympathy for some men who were in prison nearby for counseling evasion of the draft. And Holmes just gave the back of his hand to Debs. And it's interesting, Debs ran for president the next time from a federal penitentiary. Friends of Holmes really never understood how he wrote that opinion, but in any case, rather quickly, within a few months, he changed his position and came out vigorously for freedom of speech and press.
It seems that these monumental challenges to the First Amendment happen at huge intervals. There was the case in the 1790s, then more than a century later in 1918.
In fact, no claimant for free speech or freedom of the press won a case in the Supreme Court from the beginning to 1931. It took 140 years for the Supreme Court to begin enforcing that amendment. Amazing.
And then you jump to 1964, New York Times versus Sullivan.
The case was about an ad that appeared in the New York Times, supported by backers of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which said that Southern officials were racist and had abused civil rights demonstrators. And one of those officials sued for libel in Alabama, collected a huge sum from an all-white jury, and from a judge who so loved the Confederacy that he seated the jurors in his courtroom in Confederate military uniforms. And the Supreme Court overruled that huge libel verdict for the official of the city of Montgomery, Alabama, and really freed the press to cover Dr. King's movement. And, you know, Dr. King believed that if Americans generally knew the cruelties that were imposed on blacks in the South, they wouldn't like it. And it turned out when they saw people being brutalized on television or when they read about it in newspapers and magazines, they didn't like it.
Let's talk about the strange relationship between free speech and libel.
Libel was always considered to be outside the protection of the First Amendment. Libel had always been there, and people, even those who were for freedom of expression, thought libel was not protected. But then, in the case we've been discussing, New York Times against Sullivan, the formerly merely routine writ of libel was openly used by the official in Montgomery, Alabama, who sued the New York Times in the hope of suppressing the press to keep it from covering the civil rights movement in the South. So it became a political weapon, and the Supreme Court, when it considered the case, analogized it to the Sedition Act of 1798.
You come back again and again to how fragile free speech is, especially when fear is leveraged, the Sedition Act, the Red Scare, Vietnam protests. Do you think the court learns from its mistakes, or do you see the same threats time and time again?
I see the same threat time and time again. These past episodes that you mentioned have had one salutary aftermath. That is, after each one, we apologized. We realized, we, the American people on the whole, or politicians, judges, realized that the reaction to the fear had been overdone. For example, in the case of the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast during World War II, eventually Congress passed an apology and a modest payment to the survivors. But where we are now, what's disturbing about the war on terror is that it's hard to see when that's going to end, when we can look back at it, because, you know, the terrorists are not going to come aboard the United States battleship Missouri, as the Japanese did at the end of World War II, and surrender. They're not going to do that, and it's going to trail on and on. The issue is now before the Supreme Court, not in a free speech case, but in a case testing the right of the president to hold alleged terrorists who have had no kind of process to determine whether they're in fact terrorists indefinitely in Guantanamo without any fair hearing or a chance to answer charges. Now, that case is really the test of the very thing you've questioned. What have we learned from the past?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gladstone.
Tony Lewis died this week at the age of 85. In that 2008 case he mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled that detainees in Guantanamo do have the right to challenge in civilian court indefinite imprisonment without charges.
Coming up, a man who's lived most of his life in the media, but who has never been burned by the camera's glare.
That's because he is so cool. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Okay, Bob warned me that this next interview might be too New York and maybe not so media, but it is with a man who spent his life navigating the media, who proved you can have second acts if you want them. His first act brought down the house, or at least Madison Square Garden, in 1970. I wasn't a sports fan, but his speed, his cool, his name was in the ether. Walt Clyde Frazier, New York Knick.
Frazier cuts to his left, now stops and jumps. Yes! Frazier out of the back court. And one looking very west across the midfront, looses to Frazier.
With his mutton chops and his fedora, he rolled on fancy wheels through New York City, an icon of laconic cool. In that historic 1970 championship game, Knicks team captain Willis Reed, playing with a terrible injury, was the hero. But Frazier's lethal steals and stealthy buckets clinched the win.
Willis provided the inspiration. And, you know, in a way, I provided the devastation.
Frazier's little rhyme there foreshadows his second act, the one you may not know if you don't live in New York. He's a Knicks color commentator on the MSG network, famous for his truly astonishing suits, coordinated ties and pocket squares, and for his vocabulary, his rhymes. That's what got me.
Marlin and Apollo, splendor on the glass.
Erratic, dramatic, charismatic, acrobatic, NCR.
Penetrates, creates, rising on peculiar, and the left hand, ain't that peculiar?
I'm still not a sports fan, but drawn into the hoopla over then-Knicks prodigy Jeremy Lin, I found the legend of my youth, now voluble and amiable, but still cool. I read about his childhood in segregated Atlanta, changing the diapers of his many sisters, playing on dirt courts, his passion for yoga, his retreat in St. Croix, his restaurant, Clyde Frazier's Wine and Dine. How did he manage it without combusting like so many superstars, without even a surgical repair? We invited him to WNYC's Jerome L. Green Space and asked NPR sports reporter Mike Pesca to kick it off with his own meeting with the man.
The year was 1994, and I had just seen a game at Madison Square Garden, got outside, bought a pretzel on the street, and was walking away. My friend and I turned around, and there was Walter Clyde Frazier. And so I kind of smeared the mustard off my face, and I put the pretzel in my other hand. I felt that I rebounded, and then I proceeded to astound by extending my hand and saying, "Clyde, it is a pleasure to be meeting and greeting you." And he said, "Nah, nah, nah, meeting and eating." And I turned to my friend like a giddy schoolgirl, and we just said, "Clyde, rhyme to us! Clyde, rhyme to us!" And now, at 5'3", hailing from Park Slope, Brooklyn, the host of On the Media, author of The Influencing Machine, Rube Gladstone! And at 6'4", basketball Hall of Famer, commentator for the MSG Network, he played his college ball at Southern Illinois. He's a 7-time NBA All-Star, 2-time NBA champion, Walt Clyde Frazier!
Ladies and gentlemen, Walt Frazier. I started off by asking Walt about the genesis of his nickname, Clyde.
When I was a rookie, I wasn't playing well. So in order to pacify myself, I went shopping. So I dress up in my room and go in the mirror. Well, I'm not playing good, but I still look good. So one day we were in Baltimore. It was a hat store, and I see this Bossalina hat, brown velour, but it had a wide brim. And like today, everybody was wearing a narrow brim. So the first time I wore this hat, everybody laughed at me, my teammates, the opposition. 2 weeks later, the movie Bonnie and Clyde comes out. So I walk in the locker room, everybody go, "Hey, look at Clyde." So that shows you kids that if you have something you believe in, don't listen to nobody else.
A former teammate said that the legend of Clyde, your legend, was partly a media creation, but that you happily went along with it.
Yeah, that's true. Clyde is an alter ego of mine, which operated between 12 and 4 a.m. So the rest of the time, I'm Walt, nice guy from Atlanta, Georgia, that changed diapers and do all that stuff.
You know, Harvey Arriton, in his brilliant book, When the Garden Was Eden, said that you put on Clyde the way that Leonard Nimoy puts on his Spock ears, that it's comfortable if alien, or maybe it's comfortable because it's alien. Did it help you deal with the scrutiny?
Normally, I'm home alone. I never had an entourage. And, you know, when I was Clyde, I had a driver.
And that was quite a car.
Yeah, the Rolls Royce. But normally, I'm a very quiet and shy person. People laugh when I say that, but I'm a shy guy that likes to walk around in mink coats and a Rolls Royce.
Well, let me ask you about the style in your game. You, more than anyone, monumentalize the steal. Stealing on the court, as you describe it, demands cool, playing possum. It's like poker at 100 miles an hour.
I'm playing possum. I'm lulling you to sleep. I give you room so you think that you can do something. So sometimes early in the game, I could steal the ball, but it wouldn't have the same impact. So now you're dribbling the same way, and all of a sudden I come and I make the steal. It could turn the momentum of the game, and then
you're describing a pool hustle.
It's a cat and mouse game that I played on defense. But defense was my favorite part of the game, primarily because when I was in college, one year I was ineligible to play because of poor grades. So as a punishment, the coach made me play defense every day in practice for a whole year. I'd never played offense. So I said, well, if I'm going to be a defensive player, I'm going to be the best damn defensive player of the year.
We were talking in the green room about the earliest rules of the game. You said the game was very, very boring when it started. And why was that?
Because, you know, they started on a peach basket, but it had the bottom in it. So every time you scored, they had to get on a ladder and go and take the ball out of the peach basket. So it took them 7 years to figure out to take the bottom from underneath the basket.
But it seems like the game in recent years has changed a lot, too. I was watching the Knicks game last night, and it seems to be built very much around star shooters. It wasn't team play like the Knicks of the 1970s.
Well, that's true. That's one of the more blatant changes in the game. Shooting a lot of threes and dunks and nothing inside of the arc. To me, the most glaring difference in the game today, other than the money, is the size of the players. Like when I played, I was a big guard at 6'4". Today, I'd be a shrimp. I'm a point guard today because the average height of an NBA player is 6'7".
Do you wish that the three-pointer had never been invented? I mean, do you find it dispiriting that everybody focuses on taking these really long shots?
Well, it's a blessing and a curse. But today the game is entertainment. Today is who's in the stands, the celebrities, and that type of thing. So it's more focused on getting the young kids to buy the video games and the merchandising, the jerseys. And ESPN. We never had ESPN. So
right.
These guys know today if you do something, a good dunk, you're going to be number one or number two on ESPN. The only time you're going to see a good defensive play is if you block a shot to win a game. Other than that, it's all embellishing offense.
Do you find it boring?
No, I've accepted it. When I first started, I was like, oh, these guys can't play. I was like, nobody can shoot. What are they doing? Today, a guy would rather make a stupendous dunk shot and go 0-for-10, just the way the game has evolved.
The three-point shot, it's cinematic. You say it's changed because of TV, but has it actually changed the rules of the game?
Oh, yeah. They took away the hand check. Why? Because they wanted more continuity. They wanted more ball movement. Nobody liked the game. People were complaining the game is too rough. There's no movement. There's not enough shooting. So television pays the cost to be the boss. I think other than that, the rules have been better. Like when we played, the shot clock was on the floor. And I attributed a lot of my steals to guys trying to find that shot clock. Last second shot, and they're trying to look for that clock, and then I'd have the ball and go on the other way. But today, both shot clocks are above the basket. So it's much easier. You don't have to try to look for it. So I like a lot of the changes. Making the game more popular. It's an international sport now. When you look at basketball, when I played in the 70s, everybody was from the U.S. Today, a third of the players are from all over the world. It's like tennis. So it's a very popular game. I mean, look at Dennis Rodman. He's becoming a political... He's going to bring peace
America's
to the world.
Diplomat. Yeah. The 70s. New York in the 70s. America in the 70s. This was an incredibly racially charged time. Did it get to you?
Well, I actually came along at the right time. Guys like Oscar Robertson, Bill Russell, those were the guys that really kind of paved the way. So when I came into the NBA, black players, we never had to stay in separate hotels like Russell and those guys had to do. So, you know, I really pay homage to them for making those sacrifices. And then having guys like Bob Cousy and Hondo Havlicek, the white players also supporting the effort to integrate basketball. Basketball has come a tremendous way now. When you look at it, maybe it's 80-20 black now compared to 60-40 white when I came into the league. And I'm from the South, so I still believe that if not for sports, the South would be segregated.
Really?
Yeah. It really propelled them to look at people differently. They wanted to win, and they knew the black players were dominating the game, and they started integrating the schools, and that made it happen. But as far as when black and white meet, there's no color, it's just respect. And when you were playing, and that's why guys accept each other more in sports than any other venue, because of the respect of talent when guys compete.
You once said, I was never afraid of being an individual, even if it meant I was going to be ostracized for it. Well, that's never going to happen, but the wide lapels, the wild colors, not the austere style of the third millennium we're currently in. You couldn't care less, right?
I think when you're a visionary, you can't be concerned with what people think.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to just walk up and down Fifth Avenue, look at how women were dressed, how men were dressed, and my tailor was only a few blocks from there. So I see different color combinations, and I run to my tailor, and I have things made up. And a lot of times I talk to kids, and I say, don't be afraid to veer from the path and leave your own footprints. You know, I think today when I go in our schools, everybody walk alike, they all talk alike, they all look alike. There's no individuality. You know, everybody's a follower. There are not too many leaders. So we've got to get back to not being afraid to do what you want to do. But the other part of my always being cognizant of dressing for success was growing up under the oppression of segregation and being the oldest of 9 kids. So whenever I went downtown, I was not only representing my family, my neighborhood, but my race as well. So my mom was always telling me, Walt, you got to set a good example for the kids. So whenever I went out, I was aware of that. And even today, I'm still aware of that, especially when I got into broadcasting. So many of you know I wasn't using, they say, $100 words when I was a Nick player. But once I got into broadcasting, I didn't want to embarrass myself, my family, or my friends. So right away, I knew, I said, man, I have to improve my vocabulary.
So how did you do that? Bounding and astounding, creating, penetrating, erotic, acrobatic, certainly charismatic, but where did it come from?
I started on radio. So the guy that I was working with, he never gave me a chance to talk. And radio...
on the radio, that's a definite disability.
So sometimes I start talking and I couldn't shut up. He go, excuse me, Walt. He just run right over me. So then I was getting bored, and I just came up with, like, if the Knicks would make him passes, and I knew he had to catch his breath, and I go, they're dishing and swishing. That was about all I could get in, you know. They're ubiquitous. They're provocative. So to improve my vocabulary, I used to get the Sunday Times, the arts and leisure section when they critique the plays.
Oh, the plays.
Yeah, riveting, mesmerizing, provocative, profound. So people think I'm a voracious reader, but I have books and books of words and phrases. When I first started, I just studied these books over and over. And ironically, you can use cliches and no one will ever say anything. But if you use ubiquitous twice, they'll go, he used that word twice already. And then all of a sudden, I fell in love with words. Words are like people. The more you see them, the more you relate to them. And even today, like just like fashion, I'm always looking for new words and how I can incorporate them into my style.
We took audience questions, and one woman asked about how pro athletes make the transition from the limelight.
That is a daunting task that I would say 80% of professional players never make. Their marriages dissolve. Drugs and alcohol problems. Many of the players I played with or against are destitute now. Sometimes the players are so bad the teams have to bury them when they die. Sports Illustrated did an article, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago about 80% of the guys, once they leave the game, professional players, 7 or 8 years after they leave the game, they're broke. And I think the best thing that happened to me was getting traded. Leaving New York.
Going to Cleveland?
Going to Cleveland. I was all dressed up and no place to go. I used to get dressed up and go out and wear my meat. Guys go, Clyde, where are you going? So I became a homebody. I was reading a lot of self-help books, you know, because I knew I only wanted to play a couple of more years. So I was reading books that would help me make that transition into not playing. And it still took me a couple of years to get over that. So you can imagine today how players, we should fly commercially. We stayed in Holiday Inns. Today, these guys are in the Ritz-Carlton's, the Four Seasons. They have their own private plane. They're making millions of dollars. So how do you come down from that? How do you make that transition from that after you squandered your money?
How many players do you think, like you, never received a technical violation, never mouthed off at a ref, never got tossed out of the game?
Maybe 1%. I give kudos to my coaches for that. In grade school, high school, college, they never allowed the teams that I was on to talk back to the refs. We never had prima donnas. Everybody had the same rules, you know, in
but
college.
But you also didn't like the fines.
Phil Jackson asked me once, Clyde, how could you pay $50 for a pair of alligator shoes? You know, back in that day, the alligator shoes cost $50. And I go, how can you pay $25 for a technical?
Okay. This was just part of a much longer conversation. To see Clyde's dazzling suit, my pathetic attempt at free throws, and the evolution of his inimitable style, watch the video of the event on our blog at onthemedia.org. You'll hear about how he helps kids conquer fear, why his plants don't die, and the cabinet post he would have held in Bill Bradley's White House.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, DJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. Thank you to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alex Hall. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.